A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations and institutions. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll get in the Halloween spirit with Brooklyn-based Opera on Tap. The organization has begun work on the virtual reality horror opera series and recently released its first episode. My guest will be founder Anne Hyatt, and we'll talk about the Parksville Murder series and other ways the organization is bringing opera to new and unusual venues. We're going to return now to a story I mentioned last week during my news briefs. With the opening of the Grammy Museum Experience in the Prudential Center earlier this month, Newark, New Jersey reclaimed its place in Grammy lore, paying tribute to a history that includes musical greats like Frank Sinatra, Sarah Vaughan, and Whitney Houston. The Newark site is the Grammy Museum's first East Coast site, joining existing locations in the Mississippi Delta, Nashville, and the original Grammy Museum in downtown LA, which opened in 2008. The museum features a mix of Grammy memorabilia and interactive exhibits designed to encourage creativity and musical experimentation. Among the speakers at the opening was Bob Santelli, executive director of the Grammy Museum, who cited the city's jazz, blues, ragtime, and gospel traditions.
Personally for me, many years ago, a few blocks from here, I saw my first concert. It was the Rolling Stones at Newark Symphony Hall, and that changed my life forever. My dad, who was a New Jersey state trooper for many years, said that was the day he lost his son forever. True statement. And I don't regret it, quite honestly. But I can tell you this, for me as a New Jerseyan and someone who was born in Jersey City and raised in West New York, grew up on the Jersey Shore, to come back here, it's a full circle thing. And it's also a most important thing for me as a music historian, because for so many years, Newark has been overshadowed by Philadelphia and certainly New York. This city has an incredible music legacy, and some of the speakers today alluded to that legacy, going all the way back to the speakeasies and ragtime days and early jazz, Sarah Vaughan, right on through the jazz and R&B clubs, the great gospel tradition of this city. All of this has made Newark one of the most important, unheralded major music cities in America. And from now on, they're going to know about it.
The museum highlights the contributions by jazz, pop, and rap artists, and in particular on the music greats of Newark and the surrounding area, Frank Sinatra, Whitney Houston, Queen Latifah, and Frankie Valli. Among the items on exhibit is a tuxedo worn by Luciano Pavarotti, which stands in a display with shimmering dresses worn by Madonna and Ella Fitzgerald, and a gold suit from Michael Jackson. The museum comes at a time when Newark is working to revive its cultural and economic life, and as the Academy expands its educational programs to reach the next generation of musicians. Through one program, it honors a music teacher each year as its Music Educator of the Year during Grammys Week. Following the ceremony, I spoke with Neil Portnow, president and CEO of the Recording Academy, about this commitment to education.
Well, the Recording Academy is the one institution that represents a creative community. And we represent all genres. You know, we have 83 categories of music. And so part of our responsibility as the stewards of musical culture, particularly in this country, is to play that forward. And the way you do that is to get the next generation interested, involved, engaged, and then they too can be part of the infrastructure, whether it's being an artist or a manager or someone behind the scenes. So this is very vital to the mission of the Academy.
And will you see the role of the museum being here in Newark? What do you think some of the goals are going forward?
Well, we are, I like to use the term edutainment. So here's a place to come to be entertained. And as you walk around, you'll see what I'm talking about. All ages and all genres and from anywhere that comes to have this experience will have a good time, and it'll be fun. But it's also educational, because there's so many opportunities, particularly in the interactive exhibits that we have, to really drill down and see what it means to be a record producer, what it means to write a song or to sing on a record, what it means to be a manager or have a career in the arts. So that part of the mission in terms of playing it forward is going to be a critical component and one of the goals of us being here.
I also chatted with Santelli about what made the Newark Museum different from other Grammy Museum Experience locations and the Academy's educational programs.
When it comes to the interactive experiences, that's where it's different. So here, you can take a drum lesson with Max Weinberg of the E Street Band. You can only do that in Newark. Here, you can rap and sing with Wyclef Jean of the Fugees. You can only do that in Newark as well. And we have a whole section here that honors Jersey legends. So that's all unique to the Grammy Museum experience in Newark. If you go to Mississippi, you'll experience the blues and R&B and early rock and roll with Elvis Presley. So each museum is designed to tell the story of the location that they are in.
Now, I know the museum and the foundation have recently, in the last few months, have come together. I understand that the most recent list, the semifinalists for the music educators, were just recently announced. What are some of the ways that these educational initiatives have kind of redirected the Academy in terms of where it looks for programming?
Well, I think one of the most important things that we do is we honor and celebrate music education. Without music education, without arts education, the greatest American treasure, cultural treasure, which is music, stands to suffer. So we are very bullish on that, which is why we do a Music Educators Award. We also have an award called the Jane Ortner Award. That award celebrates teachers also, but teachers who aren't music teachers, teachers who still bring music into their class in history, sociology, literature, etc. So we got the education landscape covered. And I think what they're doing is, you know, it's one thing to create artists. Not everyone can be an artist. We know that. But there's another big section that we're equally interested in. That's audience. So it's artists and audience. And those are the two things that we concern ourselves with. So that if you never do get the opportunity to step on a stage, you can still be deeply connected to American music by being a sophisticated listener and fan. And that's what we hope to teach here.
There are some people in the classical music world who, when you mention Grammys, they roll their eyes. The awards are no longer televised, you know, directly very often for those categories. But I did notice you have Pavarotti's Tuxedo here. What were some efforts made to make that inclusive here in the museum as well?
Well, how about we start with this? If you were to go down to Washington, D.C. right now at the Kennedy Center, you would see a nearly 4,000 square foot exhibit on Leonard Bernstein, which is coming to New York, Lincoln Center, this coming December, and is on a U.S. tour that will take it to Boston and Los Angeles and Chicago and Tulsa, Oklahoma, Portland, Oregon. So with Bruce Bernstein, whose centennial we are currently celebrating, which will, of course, culminate in August of 18th, we have renewed our commitment to classical music, which is long overdue. You know, we have not had classical music on in a long time, but this exhibit and the related programs that go with it hopefully will get us back on track.
You can find more information on the Grammy Museum at www.grammymuseumexp.org. Opera productions have long been transporting audiences emotionally to places and times both far away and familiar. Now, opera companies are beginning to explore the possibilities of taking this a step further by truly drawing audiences into the middle of the opera through virtual reality. Several opera companies have created behind-the-scenes experiences that enable a person to take a 3D tour backstage or follow along a dancer's preparation for a performance. More recently, some have begun creating actual productions that can be viewed through virtual reality headsets. This summer, Welsh National Opera launched its Magic Butterfly VR experience, creating scenes from Madame Butterfly and the Magic Flute that could be experienced via virtual reality inside a specially equipped shipping container set up at various museums and other locations throughout the UK. Just in time for Halloween, Brooklyn-based Opera on Tap has released the first episode in its virtual reality horror opera series, The Parksville Murders. The 9-minute opera was designed to be used with Samsung's VR app, but it can also be viewed without the virtual reality benefit on other mobile devices or online. The opera features music by Kamala Sankaram and a libretto by Jerry Dye, and was directed by Carrie Ann Chimcham. It was featured at the virtual reality conference The Future of Storytelling in New York in early October, and at a Samsung VR event October 19th, before its release the following day. Opera on Tap is no stranger to experimenting with opera. It was founded in Brooklyn by Anne Hyatt in 2005 as a way to get opera into bars and other venues that brought it within reach of new audiences. Since then, it has expanded to encompass about 20 chapters, including Ann Arbor, Chicago, and Philadelphia. I invited Hyatt to the station for a demonstration, which was actually my first time using virtual reality. She snapped her smartphone into the headset and fitted that and some sound-canceling headphones onto my head. And once I focused my gaze on the play button, I was suddenly there. So it's saying, well, it's in Parksville, and I'm in what looks like a room, a shed. Bring over here. So I see a dark room with a light swinging back and forth, and an eerily glowing bathtub. Lots of smoke. There's a woman in the bathtub with lots of leaves. A ticking clock and a monitor just went on in the corner. I really do feel like I'm here. I'm in the room. I'm looking around and seeing everything 3D. Immersed in my virtual surroundings, I was truly looking in on the events transpiring, not just in front of me, but around me, as the so-called watchers robed in black surrounded the woman in the bathtub. I stopped trying to narrate what I was watching, mainly because I was trying to lose myself as much as possible in what I was watching. And in case you were interested in watching it yourself, I will not give any spoilers. After it was over, I spoke with Hyatt about the opera, the experience of using opera with VR, and other plans ahead for Opera on Tap.
I always like to say that Opera on Tap has always been sort of immersive in a way. I mean, we've always been kind of presenting opera in a very up-close kind of format. You know, we started by singing in bars a decade ago, and the whole idea is to kind of break down the fourth wall and invite the audience into kind of a more interactive experience with the performers and to kind of start peeling away at people's preconceptions of what opera is. And, you know, give an opportunity for the performers also to kind of have a different experience, you know, than they usually get. So virtual reality to me really was kind of an extension of that idea, like this idea that, yes, you can still reach new audiences. It's certainly taking it out of the concert hall, which is kind of core to our mission, is to present it in alternative venues. And here's a new alternative venue that is seeking new content and does some really magical things with audio and kind of gives creators of opera, you know, a new world to kind of play around in. And I think, you know, our writer and composer have been having a great time, you know, just experimenting and thinking about how story and music can be used to kind of tell a story in this space.
What drew you to the idea of horror in terms of genre?
Well, I think, I mean, Kamala and I, the composer, had always talked about wanting to do some kind of soprano slasher. We're both sopranos. And we thought, you know, what a great idea would be to write an opera for as many sopranos as we can possibly hire and then kind of categorically slaughter them. So it really started from a very basic concept that we always wanted to do that. And Kamala is a huge horror film fan. So, you know, it was really something that she thought was kind of a dream project. And then at the same time, it just kind of made sense once the idea of bringing it into virtual reality came about. And that really was brought in by our director, who is a filmmaker and a professor of new media at NYU. You know, horror is something that's already really successful in VR. So we thought it would be kind of an interesting piece to kind of focus on for this world.
I'm curious about the steps of production. Usually opera in and of itself, there are a lot of different elements, but now you had this technological aspect. What was it like to put it together and film it and stage it?
I mean, definitely a very different experience than what I'm used to coming from the opera world. But we really took it step by step, and we had a real collaborative relationship with our VR production company, LightSail VR. You know, they were really there every step of the way and, you know, gave us a sense of how to write for it. You know, Jerry Dye, who wrote the libretto, really, really paid attention to that and tried to think about, you know, how the point of view changes in this world when you put the person in the middle of the room versus kind of as a fourth wall in the space. So it really started with that, with the script and the creation of the text and thinking from, you know, the start how it was being built for this space. And then for Kamala, she really, you know, she really wanted to think differently about the score. She wanted it to be that, you know, we don't want to have violins in a corner off stage hidden. We want every instrument to be an object in the space. Like this idea of truly immersing you in this experience to her meant, you know, let's create the sound imprint of the space that we're in. So that really was an interesting thing for her, I think, you know, just to creatively experiment in that space. And then, you know, the rehearsal process and the production shoot, you know, was very much like a film, like in terms of how it would be done. They had to break the score and the script into different shots, you know, and so we all had to prepare for that. And I think for all the performers, it was a whole new world, you know, like take and retake and retake and retake. So that was interesting. And part of what we wanted, you know, being that this is an opera experience, we really wanted to try and capture the principles, at the least, in the space itself in terms of how the audio was recorded. And we used a spatialized audio mic that is really built for live streaming. You know, so the idea is to try to capture as much as you can in real time in the space and then have that kind of work, you know, in the 360 environment. So we were able to successfully capture both of our principles fully, like singing in on set, you know, rather than, you know, in a studio recording or whatnot. So it was a fascinating project. And I think, you know, being, and I think this goes for any kind of multimedia project where opera is involved, is just having everybody kind of really come to the table at the beginning and really create from there seems to be the best way to go.
Now, how will this be distributed?
Currently, we are exclusively showcasing our piece on Samsung VR. So if you happen to have a Samsung phone and a Samsung Gear VR headset, which is, you know, the cost is about $80 for the goggles, you can literally go to the Samsung VR app, which is bundled on every Samsung phone, and click on the app, and then you'll see us there. We're currently being featured under the Fresh area of their website, and you can download and stream the piece into your headset. If you don't have a headset, you can still watch it on a smartphone by just going to the Samsung VR app. And you can also watch it on a desktop, you know, just as a 360 video too. So if you go to samsungvr.com, you'll find it there.
Now the release was there's been a couple of events this past month. There's the Future of Storytelling event and an event on October 19th. What were some of the initial responses and who were the types of people that were there and watching it?
Future of Storytelling, I mean, is definitely, it was not the opera going crowd. It was really much more people interested in VR and augmented reality and, you know, how do we tell stories in this space, which is a really major challenge in VR when you don't control where your viewer decides to look. Like, how do you tell your story in a way that, why does it matter to that it is in virtual reality versus just a normal 2D film? And, you know, I think our piece kind of works successfully in terms of storytelling because it's an opera, because, you know, opera has been using all of these different tools to tell a story kind of, you know, in the abstract, whether it be through movement, through sound, through visuals. It's all happening at once to kind of tell the story. So I think that was interesting. And I think people were intrigued. I mean, generally speaking, at both events, which were very VR heavy, industry related, people stayed in the headset the whole time and watched the whole piece and, you know, wanted to talk about it and, you know, discuss what they were watching and where the story was going and, you know, the experience of it being an opera. So it was very interesting to kind of do that. And I think part of the strength of our piece, and certainly why, you know, Samsung VR is interested, is that people do stay in the headset for a long time and generally watch the piece from start to finish, because a lot of people don't, you know, depending on what the piece of content is. So it's interesting to think about that.
Well, that's actually something I was wondering in terms of opera traditionally has been a performing art where it's audience driven. You're there, you're presenting it for an entire audience. Granted, people aren't necessarily talking and conversing among themselves, but there's a sense of communal experience that's very different when you put on a virtual reality headset. How do you see that changing, and how did that affect the way you would imagine you will be approaching more operas like this?
Well, I mean, it is fascinating to think about how VR will move beyond early adopters because of that. You know, the fact that it is hard to experience it with somebody else, but there is that technology coming. You know, the idea of social VR is something that is definitely on the horizon. People are already starting to invest lots of money, and you can bet it's people like Facebook, you know. So that's something that will be tackled in the technology and probably sooner than later. It was actually a real point of discussion, I guess. We received a grant through Opera America to create this first episode. And that apparently was a big part of the panel discussion, was like, you know, well, is it a communal thing or not to experience an opera? Because you could also argue that you walk into an opera theater and, you know, the house goes dark and you're not supposed to talk to the person next to you while you're watching this piece. And for me, you know, I think that it is a challenge. I'd much rather have people in the space, you know, and that's certainly one thing that we are playing around with this storyline is, you know, you are the watcher. You're one of these hooded creatures. And so how cool would it be if we could actually invite live people to come into the room as avatars? You know, that's something that we certainly would love to do and are, you know, hoping and waiting for the future to come. But I think the idea that anybody can watch it from their living room sofa was really fascinating to me to think about, you know, access and distribution.
Well, looking ahead to the future, are there initial plans now to pursue more of these? And where are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we actually have a whole season planned out for this. Like, the idea is it is supposed to be a series. So we have 5 more episodes, you know, kind of planned out. And a next up for us in terms of production is to create the shrine, which is actually a portal. And ultimately, it would be the place when you enter the Parksville murders, you're going to first enter into the shrine of the evildoers. And by entering this space, you can gaze at an object, and through that object, you can enter a piece of content, whether it be a new episode, the current episode that we have up, or backstory on characters. The whole idea is that it's a branch narrative. So, you know, you may end up unlocking a final episode, which kind of ends that season. Let's hope we have more than one season, but right now we have one season.
You spoke at the beginning about how this basically fit into Opera on Tap's guiding principles. Tell us a bit how you started Opera on Tap. What was the inspiration?
Well, I was in my late 20s at the time, and I was kind of at a place in my career, quote unquote, where, you know, I'd finished grad school. I was on the audition circuit and, you know, trying to pay off my student loan debt and, you know, hold down enough jobs to stay in New York. And I was increasingly becoming disillusioned, you know, with my prospects and the whole way it worked. And I was teaching voice at the time, and I walked into Freddie's bar and back room to watch one of my students sing. He was in a country band. And I got into a conversation with the bar manager there just about how cool it would be if there could be, you know, if opera singers had an opportunity just to kind of let their hair down and sing for the fun of it, like no pressure entailed, but also kind of, you know, in a warm, casual environment like this. And he was like, let's do it. You know, so it really started from that conversation and, you know, inviting a bunch of my grad school friends, and 2 of my friends kind of came on board to help me run the shows. And then a year later, we incorporated and started thinking about what else we could do with it. And we expanded pretty rapidly after we had a nice feature in the New York Times. I think it was in like 2006 or 2007. And ultimately, like, we started spreading like wildfire. People wanted to start chapters of Opera on Tap. I mean, the beauty is that it's, you know, bars are everywhere, so you can you can find a place. So yeah, I mean, it really started as a grassroots, very organic kind of organization.
Well, now, how does that work then? Because it is one organization with chapters. Are the chapters fairly independent? And how much interaction is there and, you know, central planning, so to speak?
There is actually quite a bit of interaction. We basically, we're headquartered in New York, and, you know, we try and provide all of the kind of business aspects of the organization to the chapter. So they're umbrellaed under our 501c3. We handle business, legal, accounting, all that stuff for them, and they are really free to kind of do their own creative production stuff.
And what have been some of the things you've seen, either with the original chapter or some of the other chapters that have opened up recently?
Well, I think we certainly are really ambitious here in New York, and we've started a bunch of different types of programming. So the VR Opera is actually a part of our Roadwork series, which was envisioned to be kind of our commissioning development full production series. And this is our third project of, you know, so we have three kind of things in process, and this is certainly our most ambitious, technologically speaking, by far. We also do an education program now called the Playground Operas, where we work with kids over at 8 to 10 school sessions, and then it culminates in this production of like a professional production on their schoolyard with professional performers performing alongside the third graders that have become part of the team, if you will. And certainly some of our other chapters, too, are really starting to get ambitious with ideas of doing full productions in alternative spaces like what we're doing in bars. So it's really exciting to kind of see how you can kind of give people that license to be creative in that space.
What types of other productions or performances would a season include, you know, particularly in a bar? Is it a matter of opera singers just going and performing? But to what extent do you actually get to stage something?
Well, I mean, it really depends. I know, I think it was our San Francisco chapter did a recent production of La Boheme. I think it's like if you think more of an immersive theater experience, like if you can work with the space and kind of surround the audience with the story, that's fun and, you know, an interesting new way to do it.
So what else is, on tap for this season?
What is on tap? Well, we're definitely working our way through this project right now. And obviously, we just launched on Samsung VR on October 20th. So a big part of the next couple of months is just trying to get the word out and get as many people to go to the site and watch it, you know, as possible. And to see how it plays, you know, in terms of the analytics and whatnot. I mean, Opera on Tap is always going. We have monthly bar gigs, so we'll be at our usual places. We're always at Freddy's the second Thursday of every other month. And then we present our new brew salon series, which really focuses on contemporary music, but is kind of the same bar show format that we do at Freddy's. We do that at Barbez, generally the first Fridays of every other month. They kind of alternate.
That was Anne Hyatt, founder of Opera on Tap. You can find their website at operaontap.org. You can find more information on the series and how to view the opera, either through the Android virtual reality feature or on another smartphone, iPad, or computer, at theparksvillemurders.com. Be forewarned, as a horror opera, the video does contain disturbing images and harsh language. I hope you enjoy these conversations, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world that I bring you each week on Otempo. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, now celebrating 35 years on the air, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to Otempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. Otempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.